Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin in a moment and examine why the president is not standing up to the blackmail by the Republican leadership, who are threatening to destroy the full faith and credit of the United States unless they get their way in cutting Social Security and Medicare, while they refuse to even consider raising revenues, let alone taxing the top 1%. The Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking, Robert Johnson, joins us to explain why the President is not standing with the American people. Then, amid strikes and protests, with the Greek Parliament poised to make austerity measures required by European banks and bondholders to avoid default, we will discuss the Greek economic and political crisis with Theofanis Stavrou, who is Professor of History at the University of Minnesota and founder and editor of the Journal of Modern Greek Studies. Then finally, we'll look into the wars between law enforcement that are bound to resurface with the trial of alleged mobster Whitey Bulger, who was just arrested in Santa Monica. Maria Kramer, who covers crime for the Boston Globe, joins us. She was in court today in Boston as Whitey Bulger arrived in an orange jumpsuit to face a federal judge at the beginning of his long and painful trial that promises to be embarrassing for the FBI. I'm now joined by Robert Johnson, who serves as the Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking and is a Senior Fellow and Director of the Global Finance Project for the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute. He recently served on the United Nations Commission of Experts on International Monetary Reform under the chairmanship of Joseph Stiglitz. Previously, Robert Johnson was a managing director of Soros Fund Management and was chief economist of the United States Senate Banking Committee and senior economist of the United States Senate Budget Committee. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Johnson.
Thanks for having me on.
Clearly, at least to my mind, maybe you can unconfuse me if that's the correct term here. I don't understand why President Obama is negotiating in good faith with the Republicans who are using this idea of the United States defaulting because of the August the 2nd deadline on raising the debt limit. They're using that as leverage in their negotiations with him. And most economists say it's crazy even to have such a debt limit. No other country has it. Yet it's being taken seriously, apparently, by the White House. And to my mind, the analogy is somebody's, soaking themselves in gasoline, threatening to light a match. And instead of putting a fire hose on them, you're saying, well, we're saying, or Obama's saying, wait a minute, let me put some gasoline on myself and then we'll talk.
Well, I think there are a lot of different ways to approach this problem. First of all, we have to acknowledge that in the United States, for whatever reason, the debt limit negotiations are real, and that one body of our legislature or whoever who refuses to pass a debt limit can do a great deal of harm. Secondly, the president seems quite averse, and this causes me great discomfort, to embarrass the people who are threatening to do harm to the American credit and capital markets and the American people, ultimately. But, how do I say, third cross-section, third way of seeing this, in the aftermath of the bank bailouts, with the scope and the scale of corporate welfare in America, we're in a place where many American citizens say, I would rather turn off the faucet than use my future tax dollars to support and enable the rich and the powerful. American government appears to many to have become an insurance agency for the wealthy and the powerful, and we want to shut that off. And you can see that in the polls. Going back to last July, Pew Research Institute showed this. Democrat, Republican, Independent have very similar positions. So we're in a place now, unfortunately, where I think the media is largely, yourself accepted, malfunctioning. And what we are doing is we're pretending that people who want to collect on their Social Security, which they paid into for their whole life, or people who want to collect on Medicare and Medicaid, which are very human things, are somehow the source of the problem, rather than the financial sector, the military-industrial complex, and the medical-industrial complex, which includes insurance, pharmaceuticals, and hospitals, that are blowing out our budgets and making our health care far too expensive. We're in a dreadful place where we're not taking on power and we're pretending that citizens' reasonable demands are the problem.
But Robert Johnson, you have just made the case that the President of the United States should make, But conversely, he is buying into this threat of this Samson-like threat that we're going to pull the whole temple down. Why not call the Republicans on that bluff? Because it is, by any measure, completely irresponsible. And I can't imagine that even the Tea Party wing is going to prevail in that. Wouldn't it force the Republicans, if you called their bluff, wouldn't it force them to get real?
In my opinion and in my heart, I'm very disappointed in the president that he's not showing more spine than going after this challenge on exactly the terms that you suggest. On the other hand, if I had his job and I had to raise $1 billion in this completely dysfunctional money politics of the United States, I would be concerned about doing good policy because essentially in order to get elected, he's got to please roughly 2% of our population. And mostly what they want is subsidies to multinational enterprise and to keep their taxes low. Well-educated and healthy Americans that have health care and a school system are of almost no value now to a large proportion of that 2% of Americans that really matter in the money politics of raising $1 billion and getting reelected.
But Robert Johnson, when you talk of the money politics, does that mean that all businessmen, and I imagine predominantly they're Republicans, are that ideological, that they would go along with a kind of Tea Party strategy? I spoke with Bruce Bartlett the other day, and he railed against the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party and said, it's no longer my party. And he literally, I'm quoting him, he said, these people are insane. So I don't get it. Why would the 2% favor this kind of ridiculous blackmail?
Well, I think the 2% have private, they can pay for health insurance, they have private education, they have private security, and most of their workforce is overseas. Maybe that's a little too dark, because I believe that many, many major corporate figures in the United States now are in a place which is what you might call a dilemma between their role in representing shareholders and making money for themselves on the one hand, and the role as citizens who are born in the United States and, how we say, loyal to their country on the other hand. But at least in recent years, it appears that the money-making role has taken precedence over their role as citizens. You do not see people, for the large part, in corporate America, standing up as private citizens advocating a rebuilding of science research, education, and infrastructure in the United States, and tolerating a rise in their taxes.
Well, it's true that, except I suppose people like Bill Gates and Warren Buffett have made some pretty strong statements. In Warren Buffett's case, he said that the United States is in danger of becoming a plantation economy. We're talking about the hollowing out of the middle class here. And when you said earlier, Robert Johnson, that you felt that polls indicate that the majority of the people do not want this country to become a plutonomy. They want the American dream. They want a country based on a thriving middle class. You would think that that would be a winning campaign strategy. But I guess what you're saying is that the president has to count upon the 2% for his free re-election funds, not the 98%.
Well, I would say that Warren Buffett, George Soros, who you know I used to work with, Bill Gates and his father, wrote a wonderful book called Wealth in the Commonwealth about the inheritance tax. These people are the exceptions to the rule. And I think they are very concerned. Warren Buffett's given very, very lucid testimony in many instances about how the role of things like public libraries were the rungs in the ladder of his own development. And if he'd been born in a place like Bangladesh, he never could have achieved what he did. But I don't think we experience a great deal of people understanding the relationship between economy and society and the dreadful consequences for society and of hostility that arises, like in Europe in the 1930s after their banking crisis. People treat the economy like it's a mechanistic function. And so those people who are the most successful, like Soros, like Buffett, like Gates, part of the reason they're successful is they can see forward. They can see consequences that other people don't imagine. And they are striking a different tone than the large body of people who are fundraising or supporting something that's essentially a policy that's, how do we say, no deeper and no more powerful than just keep my taxes low. And that's really a testament to the lack of faith in the American government. In America, people will not succeed without public goods, without infrastructure, without the things that we all depend on. And no major industrial developed society does well without those things. On the other hand, people are right, very right, to be distrustful of the government and the way it's behaved in the last, say, 15 years. And how do we regain that trust? How do we build those, which you might call collective interests and actions that make us all better off? We do, how did I say, struggle to find that place now. And right now, despondency and distrust is in the driver's seat. And I think we're all being corrosively harmed by that.
And Robert Johnson, do you think that given the quality of the debate about deficits versus revenues, and obviously, logically, the only way to pay down a deficit or a debt is with revenues, but revenues are off the table as far as the Republicans are concerned, and they've turned the deficit situation into the clear and present danger and a crisis. However, this tax argument, one of the candidates running on the Republican side, Tim Pawlenty, is actually even talking about more taxes, and he's saying that this, if you cut taxes even further, you'll have a 5% growth rate per annum into the glorious future. And frankly, it makes absolutely no sense. And I'm wondering whether the debate is so corrupted now that rational discourse is even possible here, that faith has replaced fact in our political environment.
I would go to a different use of the language. I largely agree with you. But I would say distrust has replaced expertise, so that the idea of facts, what one person asserts the facts to be, is, as you know from debates on climate science, 90-some percent of the people who claim that global warming is a problem, but there are 4%, some of whom are essentially lobbyist PhDs, who have no scholarly record, are representing that this is all a mirage or a fantasy. And they are able, with large marketing budgets, somewhat supported by the energy companies, to, how would I say, sow the seeds of doubt. So expertise in the financial sector, if one's seen the Academy Award-winning film Inside Job, you can see that nobody trusts financial experts because they just drove us off a cliff. On climate change, nobody trusts experts. People have spent 25 years before they woke up the idea that inequality is pervasive and overwhelming in America, where between 1978 and the present, let's call it 2010, where the data ends, the top 1.5% of the population has taken more than 100% of the gains in GDP growth, and everybody else is worse off. Economists have not reported these things. They have not acknowledged these things. They've not studied reality. They've conformed to power and ideology. And the public is right not to trust pseudo or pretend or whatever ritualistically acknowledged expertise, because it isn't representing them. It isn't playing a fair game. So the whole place is spoiled, and false visionaries like Pawlenty and others have a lot of running room right now. And I think it's quite a sad, quite a tragic circumstance. But you're exactly right. Real ideas and real facts get no traction because the level of distrust is so high.
Again, I'm speaking with economist Robert Johnson, who is the executive director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking. You know, the one voice that I hear, and I guess in many ways he's becoming the conscience of the United States Senate, is Senator Bernie Sanders, who on the floor of the Senate said, in his view, the President of the United States of America needs to stand with the American people and say to the Republican leadership that enough is enough. No, we will not balance the budget on the backs of working families, the elderly, the sick, the children, and the poor, who have already sacrificed enough in terms of lost jobs, lost wages, lost homes, and lost pensions. Yes, we will demand that millionaires and billionaires and the largest corporations in America contribute to deficit reduction as a matter of shared sacrifice. Yes, we will reduce unnecessary and wasteful spending at the Pentagon. And no, we will not be blackmailed once again by the Republican leadership in Washington, who are threatening to destroy the full faith and credit of the United States government for the first time in our nation's history unless they get everything they want. You know, when you listen to Bernie Sanders' words, you realize It is. It's like the Republicans are like, you know, a teenager having a tantrum, wanting everything.
Let me take it to a different place. Bernie Sanders is a great American citizen. Because of the structure of politics in Vermont, he's able to speak the truth. And everything that you just quoted from him is extraordinary in the sense that it authentically represents the American people. But this isn't just the Republicans. You've got a whole lot of smarmy people in the Democratic Party on banking committees and budget committees and finance committees and so forth that created a lousy, corporate-subsidized health care bill that puts America into a budget crisis because it pays about 6% of GDP more than any other country, and America's health care quality is rated 38th in the world by the World Health Organization. You have a whole lot of Democrats who are culpable for doing inadequate and basically pathetic ritualistic attempts at financial reform because you have a broken money politics system and the health care system and the health care industries and the financial industries and the military industries are dominant in the setting of our social priorities. And to go back to President Obama, it would be nice if he would stand up to these people in this fight, except he needs to survive as what Ralph Nader calls the least worst alternative. He needs to raise $1 billion from those same industry groups I just mentioned. So this isn't a Republican or a Democrat problem. This is a social problem of incentives, and the structure of our government's broken. And everybody knows that. And some of the people in the Tea Party are just as fed up with Democrats as they are with Republicans, and I don't blame them.
There's no question, Robert Johnson, that when you refer to the Dodd-Frank bill, which, by the way, the Federal Reserve head from Kansas City just came out saying that Dodd-Frank is absolutely useless. The banks are still too big to fail, and nothing was done to lessen that looming threat that it'll all happen again. And when you refer to the Democrats in terms of so-called health care reform, what I find, again, not wanting to beat up on the president, I understand the situation he's in because it is our politics are money-driven. However, in terms of a negotiator, I don't understand why they come in asking for less than not more. Any Hollywood agent out here where I'm speaking will tell you, you always ask for more and settle for less, you know?
I couldn't agree with you more. I'm very, very disappointed in Barack Obama's sensibilities about negotiating tactics. I've been very disappointed that he appointed a J.P. Morgan executive to run the White House staff in the aftermath of financial reform. But I also would say I'm not so much disappointed in him as a person as what you might call respectful of his intelligence. What I'm very disappointed in the structure of money politics in America. He's responding rationally and intelligently to a failing system. And it's really incumbent upon people like you and me and 290 million other Americans to not tolerate that system, not tolerate the Supreme Court decisions on Citizens United, and put the incentives back in alignment where a basically intelligent man like Barack Obama can be bolder in doing the right thing instead of kowtowing to do the wrong thing in order to survive.
Well, just in closing, Robert Johnson, do you think that the president should take heed of the advice he's getting from President Clinton? After all, when President Clinton left office, this country had an annual federal budget surplus of $236 billion with projected budget surpluses as far as the eye could see. And just, you know, in the short interregnum with George W. Bush, he alone contributed to one-third of the entire national debt. And if you add his father and Ronald Reagan to that mix, that's over one-half of the entire debt that the United States has run up since the beginning of the Republic. So you would think that the Republicans, with those statistics, would the last thing they'd be talking about would be the national debt. But they've managed to put that in the center of the debate, not jobs. And that's basically what Clinton is saying. You know, let's talk about jobs. Let's inspire the country and get it working again.
Well, I believe that the question of accumulating debt with no assets, meaning there's nothing on the other side of the balance sheet, is something everyone can be against. Bill Clinton's exactly right to say that if you're going to borrow, you got to create something with it. You got to create productivity, education, infrastructure, science, research, jobs. Idle resources don't pay taxes. One of the weirdest things about this move towards austerity all over the world is that they're leaving 10, 15, 20% of the capable, viable resources on the sidelines while they're worrying about the deficit. Even Larry Summers has said in my presence at Davos, the best thing you can do is put people back to work and move the unemployment rate to 5% in order to reduce the deficit. And this, what I will call Andrew Mellon liquidationist frenzy, is really, really counterproductive, even given the goals of those people who are concerned about the debt. So I think Bill Clinton is right on track. I do think the Republicans have had a conscious strategy of running large deficits and running the debt into a place where we'd have a train wreck, and things that were largely, and you know, I worked with the Roosevelt Institute, New Deal programs, Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, would be run up against these, what you might call boundaries or psychological boundaries of fear of indebtedness, and then they would be eradicated or broken down or greatly diminished. I think that's wrong. I think the most successful societies in the world provide education, science, research, adequate regulation, education. Countries like Germany and Sweden are doing an awful lot better than America right now. And many Americans are very, very jealous, very anxious about China. China is not tearing apart its public sector. It's investing in infrastructure, science, and education at a much, much more powerful and vigorous pace than the United States. We're not losing to our competitors and then learning from our competitors. We're pretending the only thing that matters is cutting taxes for rich people, and I think that's just foolish.
I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Robert Johnson. Again, I thank you for joining us.
I look forward to speaking with you again soon.
Thank you. And I've been speaking with Robert Johnson, who serves as the Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking. He's a Senior Fellow and Director of the Global Finance Project for the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute. And he was formerly the Chief Economist of the United States Senate's Banking Committee and the Senior Economist of the United States Senate Budget Committee. We'll take a short break and we'll be back talking about the Greek crisis.
In the big old federal government, SEC is blind as bats, and the cash cow keeps producing like rabbits out of hats. The president makes good speeches, and the press corps plays along. Oh, I'm bound to go where there's lots of dough, where reality don't show, and the congressmen blow in the big old federal government. In the big